perfect sound.
Start talking about mental health. It can get better. Log on to walkinmyshoes.ie to find out more.
When I was 6 years old, I broke my leg. And I was running from my brother and his friends. Tasted the sweet perfume of the mountain grass I rolled down. I was younger then. Take me back to when I found my heart, broke it here, made friends and lost them through the years. And I've not seen the boring fields in so long. I know I've grown, but I can't wait. Cigarettes. Running from the law through the backfields and getting drunk with my friends. Had my first kiss on a Friday night. I don't reckon that I did it right, but I was younger then. Take me back to when we found weekend jobs, when we got paid. Buy cheap spirits and drink them straight. Me and my friends have not thrown up in so long. Oh, how we've grown. But I can't wait to go home. Sell clothes. One works down by the coast. One had two kids but lives alone. One's brother overdosed. One's already on his second wife. One's just barely getting by. But these people raised me and I can't wait to go home. And I'm on my way.
For World Mental Health Week, this is Walk In My Shoes Radio, broadcasting live from St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, Dublin 8.
Our love is strong as a lion, soft as the cots and you lying. Times we got hot like an iron, you and I. Our hearts had never been broken. We were so innocent, darling. We used to talk till the morning. In the strangest of places, down on the underground station, passing by. I get a mad sense of danger, feel like my heart couldn't take it. Cause if we met, we'd be strangers, you and I.
Very good evening to you. James Patrice here on Ireland's only pop-up radio station, Walk In My Shoes Radio. I have to say, I'm very excited to be here. It's been a fab week and I've been living to get in. So we've got a great show for you over the next couple of hours. Chat, interviews, lots of music. What more could you want? Because of course it is finally the weekend. 5 o'clock on a Friday night. What more do you want? If you're leaving work or college and heading out or home to chill out, we'll keep you company. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Walk In My Shoes, and you can use the hashtag WIMSFM. We're very technical altogether. And coming up this hour, panic attacks are more common than you might think. Former social worker and counsellor and current journalist Susan Clark drops in to share her personal experience of panic attacks and her top tips for coping with them. That'll be coming up very shortly. And then she regularly keeps us entertained on the national airwaves with her bubbly personality. But DJ Nikki Hayes has faced some significant mental health challenges in her life, and she'll be telling us her story at around 5:30. And then later on in the show, sleep is so important, of course, for good mental and physical health, and the bags under your eyes, but less said about those, the better. But we often do burn the candle at both ends, and we lose out on sleep. I know I do. So sleep technologist and cognitive behavioural therapist Deirdre McSwiney will be here just after 6 with her advice for how to fall back in love with sleep and getting an early night. That sounds absolutely fantastic. But first, let's have a little owl song. We're going to have Bruno Mars and Uptown Funk.
This hit that ice cold Michelle, fight for that white gold. This one for them hood girls, them good girls, straight masterpieces. Styling, wildin', living it up in the city. Got Chucks on with Saint Laurent. Gotta kiss myself, I'm so pretty. I'm too hot. Call the police and the fireman. I'm too hot. Make a dragon wanna retire, man. I'm too hot. Say my name, you know who I am. I'm too hot. And my band bought that money. Break it down. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Girls hit you, hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Cause Uptown Funk.
Tell you now, if that doesn't get you riled up for Friday, I don't know what will. And if you could see our lovely Sandman here, he's doing some fantastic moves. I'm going to see if he's free later for a drink. I'm only messing with you. Now, panic attacks They affect a growing number of us. They really do. And they can be tricky to treat. So I'm joined now by a very fabulous lady, I have to say. Former social worker and counsellor and current journalist. I like that, current journalist. You know, that sounds very official.
Just for now.
Yes. The fabulous Susan Clark is here to tell us about her experiences with panic attacks. So Susan, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much for having me on, James. And it's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, do you know what? I have to say I'm delighted to be here. And of course, we are on Walk In My Shoes Radio. And we're encouraging people to get the conversation started about mental health this week, for the week that's in it, of course. So Susan, you've had personal experience with panic attacks. Can you tell us about when they started?
Yeah. So, I mean, as you say, we're encouraging people to, start the conversation about mental health. And definitely when I started to experience panic attacks, there really wasn't that much talk about them. So my experience really was that I hid my own experience of having panic attacks for a long time. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's really great that we've come, you know, a long way. Obviously, we've a lot more to do, but so my first panic attack, James, really was on my very first day of college.
Oh, so, that's a great time to get a panic attack, isn't
it's
it?
Great. Ah, yeah. It's great for the social status, for everything, yeah. So, I was one of those kind of 18-year-olds that really wasn't ready for college. Like, I wasn't... I had been in the same school since I was four. Like, I had, you know, very close group of friends, kind of through my second secondary school, and we all kind of went our separate ways, you know, different colleges, different interests, and I really knew myself I wasn't ready, you know, I wasn't ready for college, but so I'll never forget it. My first day, walked into Trinity, and I was just absolutely overwhelmed. The amount of people, the huge spaces, and I had never had a panic attack before, so I didn't actually know what was happening to me, but all of a sudden, couldn't breathe, couldn't get my breath, sweating, and at the same time as wanting to run, I was paralyzed. So actually kind of rooted to the spot. And it's that's I think the really difficult thing about panic attacks is that kind of conflict that happens between you just want to run and get out of there. All these physical symptoms are happening. You can't breathe and yet you can't move at the same time. So my experience of them was it was a very paralyzing type of experience. And I had panic attacks for about my 4 years in college, to be honest.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So for you then, was that huge change was the trigger? Mm. Of these things, or because for someone listening now who may never have had a panic attack, I haven't, so I can't say that I've experienced it. Is it those kind of things, or is it totally different for everyone?
Yeah, I think it is totally different for everybody. And even earlier on today, actually, I was speaking to somebody, a guy who was telling me he experienced panic attacks. And of course, because I knew we were coming on to talk today, I was interested in finding out what his were like. He actually had my panic attacks were very public and always in public places. His were when he was on his own. So it can happen in different ways for everybody. And I think that's the thing is, you don't know the trigger at the time. You're just in the panic attack having it at the time. And the other ones that I would have had, I used to have panic attacks all the time on buses. So again, very public place that you can't leave, when you want to.
Which probably heightens it then even more.
Exactly. And so a lot of the time then what I used to fear was that these would happen to me wherever I was. You know, and they just come on me. So again, like you said, the anxiety about having one would, you'd be so anxious anyway. So that was definitely the thing that makes them so difficult as well, is for years I couldn't work out the trigger or why they were happening. It took me a long time to really, and a lot of work really, to kind of see really what my own kind of triggers were.
So it's almost like a journey really.
Yes,
of panic attacks.
Yeah, it has been, yeah.
And when did you first and how did you first get help?
So to be honest, I did go to the college counselor when I was in college, because I was very, very depressed at the time. I would have been, kind of a lot of suicidal thoughts for a long time.
And
I did go to the counselor, but to be honest, I remember somebody saying to me, when people do feel suicidal, it's either that they've lost their connection with the world, or they've lost their connection with themselves. They've kind of become so numb. And to be honest, it was both for me. So when I did go for help, I wasn't able to connect with somebody. I was so numb, I was so lost, I had become so isolated. I never ever told anybody that I had been experiencing this for 4 years.
No one in your friends or family knew at all?
No one. And that's really the point that we don't want people to get to. Do you know what I mean? We don't want anybody ever to experience that. And we've so many things available to us now and support supports, that means nobody ever has to get to that point. Mm. So when I did first go for help, it didn't really work for me. And to be honest, it was about 10 years later before I did go for help. And I realise now that I had just been surviving those years in college, you know. I didn't have the college experience that you're okay, supposed to have. I didn't do the learning, you know, that you're supposed to do and that kind of thing. I really was just surviving. And I took that kind of into my life then, that kind of just surviving. So that's why it took me a long time to get support.
Yeah. And did every day, I suppose, feel just like another struggle, just to get through it kind of thing? As you said, surviving. That's,
yeah.
It's no way to be.
No, it really wasn't. You're absolutely right. And I think what I did was, without knowing it, through those years, I kind of adapted in a very negative way. So I probably overworked myself at times, you know, relied on drink too much at times or other substances, probably isolated myself very much at times. So I didn't really know how to handle it. And the thing as well is, when you have an experience of panic attacks and depression and being suicidal, you never ever forget what that's like. So even though now for me it's a long time ago, it's nearly 20 years ago, I never ever have forgotten what that's like. So anytime you know, people say, oh, it's, you know, it's that length, you know, long time ago, yes it is now, and thank goodness I'm not there, you know, I'm in a completely different place, but you never ever forget. Okay. You know, so that's, yeah.
And do you find that, I suppose, keeping that memory, does that give you strength?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I did get help, the thing that really helped me was when I did start to get help, looked at, because there's a lot of CBT techniques that help a lot of people with panic attacks, and they're really, really useful. Mm-hmm. And I know lots of people that they have been really great for. They weren't actually very helpful for me because, like I said at the beginning, I would be in the panic attack. So what CBT does is, it's cognitive behavioral therapy, and it looks at changing your thinking, that'll change your feeling, and so then your action will change, your behavior will change. And but for me, when I would be in the panic attack, I couldn't control my thoughts. I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I was out of control completely. And so that feeling of out of control and powerlessness kind of took over for me. So that technique didn't work for me. What did work for me was, somebody said to me that a panic attack is actually, if you think of like a road traffic accident, so it's an emotional road traffic accident. So if you think of like the Walkinstown roundabout or the Five Lamps intersection or whatever, it's like all these emotions coming from all these different lanes of traffic and one big traffic accident of emotions. And that made so much sense to me. And then the second part of it is, so you've got all these emotions happening in you all at once, it's overwhelming, but you're trying to keep it down. So I spent years like hiding in bathrooms, hiding in toilets, trying to not let anybody see that I was experiencing this. So that really made sense for me. So when I kind of understood it to be an emotional response, that was the key for me then to start to journal. And I journaled around before and after my panic attacks, and it really helped me to kind of get to the root of them for me.
So we're getting some great tips there on coping. So we're going to have a little song first, Susan.
Yeah.
We may as well.
Oh, come on.
I think we're
having
the chain
Friday evening.
Now. Friday evening. Thank you so much, Susan. Can't wait to keep talking to you now.
Brilliant.
Thank you.
We were staying in Paris to get away from your parents, and I thought, wow, if I could take this in a shot right now, I don't think that we could work this out on a terrace. I don't know if it's fair, but I thought, how could I let you fall by yourself? Well, I'm wasted with someone else. If we go down, then we go down together. They'll say you could do anything, they'll say that I was clever. If we go down, then we go down together. We'll get away with everything. Let's show them we are better. Let's show them we are better. Let's show them we are better. We're staying in Paris to get away from your parents. You look so proud, standing there with a frown and a cigarette, posting pictures of yourself on the internet, out on the terrace. We breathe in the air of this small town on our own, cutting glass with the thrill of it, getting drunk on the past we were living in. If we go down, then we go down
Welcome back to Walk My Shoes Radio, and I'm still joined by the fabulous, lovely Susan Clark.
Oh, thanks, James.
How are you, Susan?
Right back at you.
Have you got the Friday feeling?
I definitely have after that song.
Go
it was great.
On, you know yourself. Yes. You have to have a buff. Susan, yeah. Before we mentioned the song there, you were saying that with your panic attacks, you tried cognitive behavioural therapy, but it didn't work for you.
Yeah.
So when did you eventually get to a stage where you kind of could recognise an attack and you could stop it?
So I think what I learned to do was to understand the emotional part that may have even been happening for me before the panic attack itself. So like I was saying, once that kind of emotional car crash happens, it was nearly too late at that point for me to kind of be able to pull myself out of it, because at that stage all the physical symptoms are happening.
Yeah.
So I was kind of too lost in it. But what I started to do when I found the emotional piece was I started to look at, okay, what are maybe some of the emotions that were going on for me right back at the very first one? And a lot of the other thing that people can say about panic attacks, which were really helpful to me, was they can be described as shame attacks. And again, that was something that kind of rang a bell for
me. I've never heard that before now. Yeah.
Yeah. And I hadn't either, but that experience for me in college was a very shaming experience. Like, if you think about it, you're a young teenager, this is supposed to be, you know, the best years of your life, and I just wasn't able for it. And I blamed myself for that. So I kind of shamed myself for years, like, why wasn't I able for that? And really kind of internalized that and gave myself a really hard time about it, and always kind of felt like I'm not good enough. I knew I was good enough academically, even though I would fail exams because I wasn't showing up for college and everything, but I never felt good enough just in who I was, you know.
I think you've nailed the head there as well, you know, with confidence and that, because I've always said that confidence is like an onion. I think there's levels of it.
Yes.
You know, so you're saying there you were super confident in your academia, in your ability, in your mind, but then you lacked it elsewhere, so...
Yeah, that was the huge thing for me, James. I had never failed an exam in my life before I went to college, and because I wasn't able for it socially or in all those other ways, I just didn't have that skill set, and I didn't know I didn't have it until I went there. Like, I did know something inside me wasn't ready for this, but I didn't know why. So when I started to really look at that and see that I had kind of experienced this shame attack and saw it in that way, I started to journal around that kind of topic and other areas in my life. And then I realized a lot of why they would happen to me in social places was around that same thing. It was still with me about that kind of social anxiety and social kind of shame. And that really helped me. So now, one of the things that I would really say helped me a lot, because what happened to me was, this is really interesting, was I didn't have them for years. Okay, so went and got help, you know, talked through a lot of things, didn't have them for years. Then last year, I went through I had about 3 in 1 month last year.
Out
of nowhere. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And this might sound kind of like trivial to some people, mm-hmm. but what I've learned is if it's not trivial to anybody else, if it's important to us, it's important. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So I had set a goal in a gym I was in. And I didn't reach the goal. And I had that set. It was in a very public way. And it was a very, exactly the same experience. Like I had attached a lot of meaning, you know, to this goal, whatever. Yeah. I didn't make it and I thought I was a failure. And it was that very kind of shaming experience again. And so I had those panic attacks again.
Oh
very, yes, in succession. But I think as well around that time, I probably wasn't looking after myself in ways that I've learned to do now, mm-hmm. you know, so that was probably part of it as well. But what I would say is one of the things that I, when they happened to me last year, was I didn't hide them. So there I was sitting on Leeson Street. I didn't care who saw me.
Good woman.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Who cares? Yes. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and so you're saying then it's that element of defeat and that kind of shame that really spirals things on more.
And when we take that in on ourselves, you know, and hold it in. And that's really one of the things I'd say to people is what helped me really was not to hide it. So if I would say to people, if you're somebody who experiences panic attacks or anxiety attacks, shame attacks, whatever you want to call them, I'd say to you, pick two people in your life and tell them.
Okay.
You know, trusted people, tell them, put them in your phone and say to them, if you're not with me when this happens to me, can I call you? And when I did that, like my friend said to me, well, don't get on the phone and start going, well, how are you? And wait for me to ask you how I am. Yeah. Tell me, I'm having a panic attack. Yeah. Can you listen to me?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing for people to do is tell those two people, if they're not with you when it happens, ring them on the phone and say, I'm having a panic attack. Can you listen to me? And really tell the person what you're experiencing physically. And that really brings people back into their bodies. The other thing that's really important is when you can't catch your breath, your instinct is to kind of, you know, try and kind of go like that. And that's, even though it's almost counterintuitive, what's a better thing to do is actually to blow out. So
okay.
The same way as you would if you were running and you got a stitch and you were told like, blow out, and that we then automatically take deeper and slower breaths.
Yeah.
So even though it's counterintuitive, it's a really good thing to do. And even those two things alone empowers you. So you feel, actually, there's something I can do, even though I'm in this and this is happening. So when that happened to me last year and I kind of got that little relapse of them, I had those two things that I knew to do and they didn't last as long. And I felt that connection to somebody on the other end of the phone that knew what I was experiencing. And that was so important for me. And I never had that before. Yeah.
Wow. That's so. And you know something? I mean, obviously, now, not to trivialise, but it's not simple at all. Mm. When you boil it down, you literally having someone there to talk to essentially changed everything for you.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And people, like if people are the listener, you know, when somebody is panic attack, I would say things like, this is going to be over soon, mm-hmm. you know, this mm-hmm. isn't going to last, you know, this isn't going to last too long, which, because, you know, the kind of aftermath doesn't, once people have that connection, I think it does help. And even the guy I spoke to today said the exact same thing to me. He said he's learnt as well. He's to ring somebody because he has them when he's on his own.
Yes.
And he said that, you know, so that I think that connection piece is really important.
Well, so, I mean, that's amazing. Literal tips there from you, Susan. So practical. And before I let you go, you're a busy lady, I know. If someone is listening right now and they suffer from panic attacks or they suffer from anything that doesn't make them feel fabulous, as I say, what would you say to them to do, to talk to someone?
Yeah, I think really, James, like that's the whole message of the station that we're saying, like, is you don't have to be on your own. Mm-hmm. You are never on your own. And that's one of the really important pieces for me and why I love the station and what it does every year is because it helps me to know I'm not the only one. I never was. I just didn't know it. So no matter how isolated somebody feels, just reach out for support. And the other thing that really comes across to me from the week of Walk in My Shoes is the will of people to help others. Like
Absolutely.
Everybody really really wants to be there for people, especially when they're in difficulty. So never doubt that somebody will be there. There is help. And as you said earlier, if it's not one particular help that you find useful, there's lots of different kinds. So don't give up.
Amazing. Ah, Susan, you are an inspiration.
And you're That's fabulous. Thank you so much.
Oh, God, I am not. You're inspiration and I'm perspiration because it's quite warm in here. So Susan, thank you so much for the
you,
chat.
James.
And thanks just for being so amazing. We're going to have another little song now, Susan. I'm going to bid you adieu.
Thank you,
and
James.
And after the song, we'll be chatting to the lovely DJ Nikki Hayes.
Support, we can all enjoy life. Taking that first step is possible with St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. If you have concerns about your mental health, talk to your GP or call our support line on 01-249-3333. Don't wait to enjoy life again. St. Patrick's Mental Health Services. Empowering recovery.
Thank you.
are we all? James here on Walk in My Shoes Radio. Hope you're having a nice evening if you're driving home from work or you're just finished college. We hope we're giving you a bit of a good buzz. So, of course, we're here on Walk in My Shoes Radio. We're raising awareness for World Mental Health Week. And I have to say, it's been a great week. They have had some amazing people in. They have had RTE presenters. They've had Justin the Turkey. They've had Egypt's Like Me. I mean, it's just fantastic. So if you want to get in touch with us, of course, you can tweet us. It's at Walk In My Shoes, and you can use the hashtag WIMSFM. So it's Walk In My Shoes FM. And I'm now going to be joined by someone who I'm sure we all know from the airwaves. She's a fun, she's a fabulous, she's a friendly presenter on radio stations like 2FM and Spin 103.8. And she's the author of Crying Into the Saucepan. But Nikki Hayes, the lovely Nikki Hayes, has been dealing with borderline personality disorder for a long time. And Nikki joins us now on the line to tell us more. Nikki, are you there?
Hello, my darling. How
Hello,
are you?
Nikki. Do you know what? I have to say, I'm having a bit of a fangirl moment because I would have... Growing up listening to you now on the L Radio.
You see, I'm an L one at this stage. It's terrible.
Oh, you're not an L one at all. You're amazing. No, I have to say, I am delighted to be talking to you. So welcome and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's been a bit overwhelming. It's kind of like I spent so long, you know, going over it. Am I writing it? Yes, I'm writing it. No, yeah. I'm not. Yes, I am. And then it's kind of here and it's like, well, okay, that happened very quickly.
Oh, it's amazing. Fair play to Nikki. So Nikki, I'm going to jump right in with you. Could you explain for the listeners, what is borderline personality disorder?
Okay, well, borderline personality disorder is a mood disorder. It is something that really up until recently wasn't thought of or, you know, wasn't kind of known. A lot of people weren't educated to it, although they have kind of brought it back to as far as Marilyn Monroe and Diana, Princess of Wales, that they believe they suffered with it, and Angelina Jolie does too.
Right.
So, you know, if you look at their characteristics and stuff, a lot of it would, you know, involve extreme emotional distress. So, you know, disproportionate reactions to things where someone might normally, you know, be upset if something happens. We would be devastated. It would consume every moment of our lives that we would be so, so upset about a certain thing. So it's all about disproportionate reactions, emotional responses, and also a very, very deep body image problem where you see yourself as the most horrible thing in the world. You hate yourself to a level where you might self-harm, have suicidal ideology. You know, it's a torture to live with, and unfortunately it can take a long, long time to diagnose because of the fact that it takes various different components in order to come around with the diagnosis. So, like, if I have borderline personality disorder and James Patrice has borderline personality disorder, which he doesn't, I'm not saying he does. You would have a completely different set of criteria that you might have met that I would have. There's nine different symptoms, and you only have to meet five of them in order to qualify to have borderline personality disorder.
And Nikki, when did you get diagnosed with it?
I was only diagnosed 2 years ago, so, you know, I've always kind of struggled with my mental health from the time I was younger. I first presented to the mental health services with anorexia in my teens. Then I went from that to a suicide attempt, to anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress, body dysmorphia. It's 20-odd years in and out of the mental health services. But it was only 2 years ago that they actually joined the dots and went, oh, okay, actually you've had this.
And
so they started to treat me correctly, so...
Okay, and what was it, I suppose, you know, a sort of a bittersweet relief when they did?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for years, I just didn't understand why I was the way I was, why I was so spontaneous and impulsive. And I don't mean spontaneous and impulsive in a good way. Yeah. I mean, you know, to the point where I would self-harm extremely dangerously. Mutilate myself to the point where I had to be hospitalized. But I didn't see that as a big deal. Because of the impulsivity and the disproportionate reactions to things. So, you know, to finally actually have a diagnosis and a treatment to treat us, you know, correctly, it's kind of like I look back and I think, oh, okay, well, that kind of makes sense now. And now I'm getting the tools to kind of make sure that doesn't happen again. So I'm on the correct medication. I know a lot of people don't like medication, but for me it's essential because I do have an imbalance. I need a mood stabilizer. I need an antipsychotic to slow me down to make the right decisions, and I need an antidepressant. So for me, they're essential. And then what comes after that is I'm now learning through DBT how to actually, you know, manage myself on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And Nikki, so you're saying then it's it totally different symptoms for different people. So then it's a totally different treatment plan then, obviously, for everyone as well, is it?
Yeah, well, they use the DSM-5 medical report to diagnose borderline personality disorder. And, you know, I'll give you a couple of criteria. Self-harm would be one. Extreme anger would be another one. It's actually the only one on the 9 that I don't meet because I internalize all my anger to myself. But there would be eating disorder, substance abuse. You know, there's lots of different ones. But because you only have to meet 5 of them, you could have completely different ones to me, and your treatment would be tweaked, obviously, to suit you then, yeah. You know, because you mightn't have the emotional dysregulation that I have, and for that, I need the medication to stabilise my mood.
Oh, okay. And is the treatment kind of fluid, Nikki, where, you know, symptoms might change over time, so then your treatment might change too?
Yeah, I believe so, because, you know, for the 2 decades that I've been in native mental health services, I was like a guinea pig. I was constantly being put on different types of medication and, you know, let's see what works. So I presume that, you know, as I grow and my hormones change and whatever, that, you know, I will need to have these particular medications treated as well. But for now, they're the right ones for me. And, you know, I hope that I continue to stay stable, but I guess it's going to take an awful lot of work for me, and it will depend on how I react to situations going forward. So.
Well, Nikki, I have to say, so I'm going to keep you in the line because I just think you're amazing and you're a total inspiration. So when we come back after the song, you're going to have a chat about your book. I have to say, it's the best title I've ever heard, Crying is the Saucepan.
I love
the cookbook, though. But we will clarify, we will get the official line after this song. Nikki, thank you so much.
Thanks, Darren.
Some kind of holiday. You got me thinking that we can run away. You wanna take you there. You tell me when and where. Oh, 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 oh. But then I asked for your number. Said you don't have a phone. It's getting late now. I gotta let you know that everybody wants to take you home tonight. But I'm gonna find a way to make you mine. Don't stop doing what you do.
You're listening to Walk in My Shoes Radio, and I'm still on the line with the fabulous DJ and now author Nikki Hayes. Nikki, how are you keeping?
I'm good. I'm enjoying your music, by the way. I'm into that too, and I came on earlier on. I'm really enjoying your choices.
It's a bit of, well, I'm campaigning to get a bit of steps on before I finish.
You have to. They're playing in a couple of weeks.
But that's what I'm going. I'm very excited. So I think we need to. So Nikki, you've just been so open and honest and frank, and I can't thank you enough for it. You've been chatting about your mental health and living with borderline personality disorder. But of course, you've now written a book. When did you decide to put pen to paper and to talk about your experience?
Well, after I had my mental breakdown 2 years ago and I was hospitalised for a couple of weeks, when I came out, I started to blog. So, you know, I had so many people contact me and say, you know, what led you to this and whatever. So I decided to put a blog together on WordPress, as many people do. And it was from that, you know, I was contacted and someone said, did you ever think of writing a book? I was like, God, no, not ever. And then, you know, the more I toyed with the idea and the more people that were contacting me about mental health issues, I thought, you know, maybe I need to do this. And Mercier Press were like, we want to do this with you. So it kind of, it happened quite organically. And it was daunting because I've never, bar blogging, I've obviously, being a radio person, I can talk forever.
Yeah.
If you ask me to sit down in a regime and actually write something, it can be a bit difficult. But it kind of came together then after that.
And what was it like to just kind of sit down and literally write that first word? Was it immediately kind of a release for you?
It was gas. Like, James, I sat down and I had no idea how to obviously write a structured piece. So I did, do you remember when you're in school and you do the bubble that looks like a spider?
Yes.
A different team coming out of it.
Because we learned something from school. It worked. Yeah.
One thing. So my little bubble spider, I kind of started off with that, and that's how I kind of decided what was going to go into the chapters. And then, you know, there was quite a lot of edits and rewrites and, you know, because I obviously have never written a book before. So The publishing team were just amazing. They really directed me in the right direction.
And did you find the whole thing therapeutic?
Yes and no. Yes, in a way that, you know, I felt now I can be myself. I don't have to pretend anymore. I can say, yeah, okay, this, I am bubbly, I am positive, but then I also have really, really bad days too. So for that, it was a relief. And yes, it was therapeutic and I felt I didn't have to, you know, pretend anymore. But in the same way, when I was writing it, it was quite triggersome. So as I wrote about self-harm, as I wrote about, you know, deep depression, unfortunately, these thoughts and, you know, patterns did start to kind of rear their head in my life.
Really?
Again. So, yeah, so it was very, very triggersome. And the hardest part was, you know, 7 years ago, I felt like my fairy tale had come true and I met the love of my life. And, you know, he accepted me for me and for who I was, scars and everything. But unfortunately, with the triggers that were coming up while I was writing the book, it was too much and our marriage ended in May. So,
oh my goodness, Nikki.
Yeah, so unfortunately, you know, I'm still very much in love with him and he's a great father to our daughter, but it was just, he extended his limits time and time again. But living with someone with borderline personality disorder is extremely difficult, more so because everything looks okay on the surface. And then all of a sudden, you know, everything could be great. We could be out for dinner and the next morning I'm in A&E. That's the way it kind of happens, with the impulsivity. And it can be very, very difficult to plan and, I guess, live around that kind of spontaneity and disruption.
Yeah, and I suppose I can only imagine then, you know, you have all of these thoughts and these experiences and it's bad enough in your head. I suppose maybe literally physically writing them down and seeing them on paper, you know, and confronting them like that, it probably is even more difficult then.
It kind of felt in some ways like I was back there, you know, as you're writing where you were at a particular time and the feelings that you had, you're back there. And, you know, in some ways that when the book was out and, you know, I was finally done and I handed it over to the publisher, there was a sense of relief because that's it, now it's down and I don't have to do any more. But while I was writing it, yeah, unfortunately, it was quite triggersome. But that's something, again, that I'm learning through DBT to control better, because, you know, CBT is great and it gives you coping skills for the here and now, but dialectical behavioural therapy, there you go, just goes that layer deeper, and that's something that I need. I need to reprogram how I do things.
So it's dialectical behaviour therapy.
It's DBT, yeah. The guys there will probably tell you to pronounce it correctly, but yeah, it's DBT, and it just basically, it's a year-long course that I do with the mental health team, and basically they go through 6 months of coping skills and how to reprogram how you react to situations emotionally and try and apply some logic, and then you stop and you start the 6 months all over again.
Wow.
So it's programming you, you know, because unfortunately with borderline personality disorder, the emotional dysregulation, the patterns keep repeating themselves.
Mm.
But every time you get well, you can end up back in hospital because you're self-harmed, then you're well again, and then you try to commit suicide, and then you're well again, and you try to starve yourself. You know, and it's these patterns that just keep going and going. So with DBT, you're trying to remove that pattern and be able to identify it before it gets to that point.
So the good thing about DBT then is it kind of evolves with you.
Yes, yes, and it's really just programming yourself to know what's happening before it happens, instead of waiting to that moment where it's like, everything's great, bang, I'm back in hospital. It's about trying to, you know, unravel that pattern.
Okay. Well, Nikki,